Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre podcast for the 2nd of October 2011. My name's TRP Watson, and this week I'm joined by Phil from the West End Whingers, Glenn Pierce, and Rev Stan. Okay, we're going to start by talking about The Veil. This is a new play by Conor McPherson at the Littleton Theatre. It's set in rural Ireland in 1822. It's a big country house owned by an Anglo-Irish family, which is gradually going out of business. And you have the mother of the house who is, essentially auctioning off her daughter to a rich family in Northamptonshire. And two people are dispatched from Northamptonshire, a cousin and his friend are dispatched from Northamptonshire to this crumbling Irish manor. These two men are sent to chaperone the young girl off to get married, but there are lots of hidden secrets, family secrets, and the possibility that the horse is the house is haunted. The horse is hunted. Yes, the house is haunted. So we get into familiar Conor McPherson territory of sort of a haunting, a slightly supernatural story. He never gives us a rational explanation for things. I mean, you know, his supernatural is probably supernatural. The play itself, I thought was well acted. I just thought it was a bit flabby. I thought it wasn't focused enough for my liking. It was a little bit overlong. We did see the first preview, so the usual preview warnings happen here. But Phil, what did you think about it?
Well, I agree with you that it was completely flabby. Andrew, with West End Whingers, left at the interval. We've been doing a lot of that recently, but I just thought it set up enough sort of atmosphere in the first act, rather long first act, to kind of... I wanted to see where it was going, and I knew there was a seance coming, so I wanted to see that, which was, I thought, very well handled, and it was quite spooky, but I don't really know what it was getting at. Apparently, on the website, it says it's about the search for love, the transcendental, and the circularity of time. But the only circularity of time in the second act was me watching my second hand go round on my watch, because I did really struggle towards the end of it. It was far too long. Yes, I agree, it was the first preview, so it may be cut. But because it's directed by Conor McPherson, you do wonder whether he will be cutting his own work very much. And I don't really think, actually, that was just the problem. It was just... It was far too long, actually. That was one of the problems. And I really didn't get what it was getting at. Did you?
Yeah, I thought... I mean, it's something I'm a bit worried about with the National Theatre, that they haven't... They don't get people... You know, it's almost as if their literary department aren't getting in with a lot of these people who direct their own work, a lot of these writers who direct their own work, and sort of say, you haven't worked it out, you know, you haven't focused enough on it. Because there were... two or three characters in that play who were sort of interesting, but that you never went anywhere with them. You know, something like that. You had this old grandmother, and it was almost like Cluedo, where you sort of say, well, is it going to be this person who is most affected by whatever supernatural thing's going to happen, or is it this one, or is it this one? And none of them are properly drawn. And it was almost as if he sort of cut out two characters and refocused, it would have worked an awful lot better, I thought. And I mean, it's not that it's badly written or anything. It's just that, you know, that overlong, and you just don't care about the characters anymore, because he hasn't sort of zoomed in on them and given them a proper story. I mean, you could always say, well, you know, nobody has a proper story in real life, but this isn't supposed to be real life. It's also outside his... I think it's also slightly outside his comfort zone. I mean, this is... Usually he's dealing with Irish characters, he's dealing with a fairly contemporary or up-to-date story, and this is 1822. It's... most of the characters, I think five of the eight characters are... English, or at least, you know, mostly English, you know, think of themselves as English. But it was, yeah, it's outside his comfort zone. And there's also that very tempting thing, because it's 1822, you get that idea of him, of a sort of Frankenstein, because that's about the time that Frankenstein was written. And of course, Frankenstein is written in a sort of cold and wet house, a big house on Lake Geneva, and there was almost that feel to it, or I was hoping there was going to be that feel to it, you know, telling that kind of ghost story in that kind of environment. But it didn't quite work out for me. I mean, it's very good performances. You know, you've got some really good people in it. You have Breege Brennan and Jim Norton, Adrian Schiller and Fenella Woolgar, who sort of all stood out pretty well as in their parts. But sorry, no, okay. I got some talk back. Okay, carry on.
I did like Peter MacDonald as the estate manager, Fingal. I thought his performance, for me, was the best one. Jim Norton, I mean, I assume he was meant to be an irritating character, but I began to find him so irritating as the play went on that when somebody in the second act takes a gun to the rest of the cast, I just thought, mow them down, because I really didn't care about them, and I particularly didn't care about him. He was strange, camp, sort of defrocked reverend. I don't know if he was meant to be providing comedy sort of relief, but it was a very strange, unlikable character that was created by him. And I thought the grandmother was rather strange, as you say, because she was silent for quite a long part of the play. And then when she started to speak, you assumed she was slightly senile, but she was quite articulate when she did open her mouth, which seemed a bit strange. I don't know if there was some sort of point to that, but...
Well, I think it sounded like. I mean, it seemed like somebody sort of drifting in and out of dementia, that kind of thing. But yeah, it was a bit confusing at times. And again, you didn't quite, you know, she didn't get a full story. You didn't really get what she was all about. And I think that was a problem. And it worries me that this is something that the National Theatre seem to do. You know, they're not, that perhaps that their literary department aren't sort of brave enough or confident enough to sort of read a play and sort of nudge people and say, well, you know, is there enough here, and are you doing the right things? I mean, they have had some rather major nasty bits happening. I mean, I also thought that Earthquakes in London was a bit flabby, and I thought that and of course we can go back to we can talk about Fram if you like, but it is a bit worrying on the part of the National Theatre, especially when we've got a new major Mike Bartlett play coming in to the Littleton later this month. Do you think that's going to be a problem? Or do you think that is a problem, or am I imagining it?
No. I mean, for us, it's a problem because they're just too long. And I think audiences don't really like them. If they're not, I mean, they can be. If they're very contained, long can be fantastic. For instance, Jerusalem, which obviously is not the National Theatre. But, yeah, cut it. I mean, there were some good lines in this that I particularly liked. The one Ordell was talking about his sordid interior escapades, which I thought was a marvellous phrase. And there were a few lines like that, but just cut it down, you know, condense it. I could hear a lot of people at the interval making negative remarks about it. Yes, it was the first review, and I heard other people leaving, not just ones who, people we were with, other people walking out, and there were definitely some empty seats in the second act. And I think the audience were giving up on it by the end. I think you could tell by the applause at the end. It was very, very reluctant applause, I think, from the audience.
Yeah, perhaps. I mean, I've seen one or two people on Twitter coming back and saying that they quite liked it. So we'll have to see what the final reviews say.
Yeah, but the thing is with the critics, I think it's slightly different from what audiences feel, because they will bend over backwards to sort of see it from a proper critical perspective, which we certainly don't. We see it from our own perspective. And sorry, I've lost my thread now.
I see what you mean, and especially they will, you know, they'll contextualise it, and they'll, you know, think of it in terms of Conor McPherson much more than an audience does. Because I mean, I was looking at it, and as a piece of Conor McPherson, it's not as good as say The Seafarer or the Weir, yeah, of course. Yeah. But you know, are people big Conor McPherson fans? I mean, obviously the critics will be, but not but most, you know, ordinary punters will have heard the name, but this might be their first experience, and it's a bit of a letdown. But then again, as we say, it is a preview, so we've got to be a bit careful.
Yeah, well, We've only just put our review up, and we've started to get comments, and we've had a couple so far, which is agreeing, and I think one of them had from somebody who left at the interval as well. So I think for an audience point of view, and that's probably from yesterday, so that's well into previews, that perhaps people, well, certainly the ones who are leaving comments so far are people who haven't liked it. So I don't know that it's going to be a great crowd pleaser for them.
Okay, we're now going to talk about Cool Hand Luke at the Aldwych Theatre. This is an adaptation of the famous film starring Paul Newman. A prison movie. It stars Mark Warren, and I'm seeing Lee Boardman up here as well, which is as a name that jumps out. Glenn, what did you think about this?
Hold my hand up here. I must be one of the few people in the country that's actually never seen the film. So I actually went to it cold. And I shall put the usual disclaimer at the beginning. This was a preview performance. Press night is on Monday, so comments do take into account that it was a preview performance. It's actually based on a 46-year-old novel by Don Pearce, who, again, disclaimer, no relation of mine, I will say. And it's actually a semi-autobiographical novel. He was actually a fairly minor criminal and did spend some time in Southern States Jail. So some of the experiences that are in the story are based on his experience there.
Yeah, this is. I should point out this is a chain. You know, this is a story of a man on essentially on a chain gang, isn't it? Or state farm or something like that, isn't it? I mean, they spend lots of time working like that.
It is. I mean, it's very much Southern States, Blazing Sun. You know, in a way, you know, it could be a set for Tennessee Williams play when you walk in. It is very much that Deep South Sun. And yes, it's a tale of Luke Jackson, who's sent to jail for some fairly minor crime. He was vandalising some parking meters. And this sort of petty crime leaves him to originally a two-year prison sentence in this very tough Southern State prison. And he's sent out on the chain gang under the blazing Southern Sun. And it's a bit of him finding his role in that prison, finding his pecking order, and sort of how to fit in. And it's told through the stage play is very much a series of montages of scenes held together with Southern gospel music. It's a predominantly male cast, so the females that are in the cast tend to play sort of mainly supporting cast, but there is a sort of central gospel singing narrator called Mary, who provides sort of commentary and sort of the musical accompaniment to it. But the story itself follows Luke, which is the Mark Warren plays the character, through his time finding his feet in prison and the increasingly sadistic treatment he receives from the guards. He's not one to conform, so he's always testing the limits of the prison, trying to escape, trying to push the rules, and it's the impact of that increasingly harsh regime. For someone that went new to the story, I think it works really well on stage. It's flows well, although the scenes are quite, as I said, fragmentary, and you get lots of short scenes held together by this sort of musical narration. It does flow, and it's really quite an intimate piece. Mark Warren as Luke, although I've not seen the film, obviously you see clips, and it's, you know, perhaps best, you know, Paul Newman is in everyone's mind, but he brings something really to himself to the role. There's quite a sort of quiet inner torment bubbling away there. And it's actually sort of quite mesmerizing to watch on stage, even when he's not speaking lines. It's a real focused performance. Lee Boardman, you mentioned as Dragline, who is, until Luke arrives in the prison, possibly the sort of the ringleader. Again, very strong performance. Lee Boardman's, I think, turning into a great stage actor. You know, a lot of people know him from his television work, but very good stage actor. Sandra Marvin, say, this is the nature of the play, very little perhaps for the female cast to do, but Sandra Marvin as Mary, this narrator, very good, very strong singing voice, but also provides a bit of social commentary to it and provides that outside edge that, you know, stops it being a purely prison drama. It does flag in a couple of places in these early previews. The pace does drop. That's something I'm sure they can work on, may have worked on, you know, in a few days since I've seen it. Design looks stunning. I said it's a sudden set play. Yeah, it does look very good, and it does shift from location to location very well. I think for me, the slight drawback of the play, not necessarily any fault of the production, the final 15 minutes should really build up to quite an emotional climax, and they do lose something. It's told in flashback, and I won't give away the ending to anyone, but it does seem... So the 5, 10, 15 minutes do seem to have lost the way slightly. But overall, I think it's a very good book to film to stage adaptation. So I've never seen the film, so I can't really compare it with the film. I think it will do very well.
Yeah, there are several. I mean, there are some. Obviously, there is a famous line from the film, which is what we have here is a failure to communicate, which I think was probably in there. The other, well-known set piece is, of course, the egg-eating competition. I don't know that it is actually physically... I've seen a programme on television where they physically proved that it is physically impossible to eat 50 hard-boiled eggs. You run out of saliva and your body, your stomach actually can't keep them, you know, put them in and fit them.
There was a scientific there's actually a scientific equation given in the show explaining why they think it's impossible.
I mean, you don't have enough. It's quite good fun, and presumably obviously they're not going to show him eating 50 eggs. Does he eat a few?
He does. All I would say is if you are sitting in the dress circle, they need to look at sight lines, because it does. From where I was sitting, you can see how he manages to eat approximately about 30 eggs you see him eating on stage.
Heavens.
But sitting in the dress circle, you can work out how it's done.
Right. Okay. I think there's a car washing scene in the film. I can't remember if that's that one or another. I think there is a famous car washing scene in the program, but I'm not entirely in the film. It's
not on stage. There's no car washing on stage.
So that's not done. It's basically they see a woman in the distance and washing a car, and she's not wearing. Well, she's obviously not wearing an awful lot, so because she doesn't want to get wet. Presumably that's not in there. But there's a lot of. I mean, the thing is that there are quite a lot. It's, you know, well known enough films, so you get a lot of quotes if you watch. You know, on television, they'll often take off Cool Hand Luke. But it is certainly something. I haven't seen it yet. I'm seeing it next week. But it's something I'm quite looking forward to, and I'm probably going to go back and watch the movie either before or after it, because I think it's certainly worth doing it. But it's sounds quite good fun.
No, I'm going to watch the film now.
Yeah.
The concern I have for it, and again, I saw it at a preview last week, I just hope it does find its audience, because it was telling that I saw it on Wednesday evening, and one level closed in the theatre, and the dress circle only had three rows of people in. So it needs to find an audience. So if you're a fan, go.
Yeah, I mean, it may well be a problem. I mean, you can often tell the things I've got offers for and the things I haven't. I got an offer for this one. I haven't had offers for other things like The Tempest or even Driving Miss Daisy, which we'll probably talk about next week. It's always a little bit worrying. And is he a big enough name to open it? I mean, you know, we know who he is, but it's sort of a little bit tricky.
There was an American lady sat next to me. We were actually shifted on Wednesday, obviously because it was quiet. They moved us down a couple of rows, and she knew the film, knew the book. But didn't know anything about the cast, and obviously Mark Warren didn't resonate with her. So I'm not sure, obviously we know, I'm not sure if he is a big enough name perhaps for the American audience that would possibly be a large contingent.
Yeah. We're now going to talk about When Did You Last See My Mother, which is Chris Hampton's first play, written when he was 18 and precociously and disgustingly talented. This is about a couple of lads living in a bedsit in London shortly after leaving school, possibly before going to university. What did you think about this, Riff Stan?
I really enjoyed this. I was there the same night that Ought to Be Clowns was there, and I think in the interval he described it as baby Buttley. I didn't particularly like Buttley, but this I did very much enjoy. The central character is this precocious 18-year-old. He's super intelligent, very sharply witty and manipulative. But he has some endearing qualities about him because I think of his youth. He's obviously struggling against a lot of emotional stuff. He's very self-deprecating. He has a bit of a crush on his roommate that he's sharing this bedsit with. And he's obviously struggling with that. He doesn't know quite how to deal with it. And I think that for me was the endearing quality and why I think Ian described it as baby Buttley, in that he's got all the sort of the intelligence and the sharp, witty, manipulative verbal dialogue. But there were some endearing characteristics about this character. And Harry Melling plays the lead. And I was just absolutely pleased as punch to see him playing a lead role, because I've seen him take on sort of like smaller roles in sort of ensemble pieces at the National, and he's always stolen every scene that he's been in, and I've been dying to see him play, take the lead role in something. And I think he does an absolutely amazing job in this. And it's a very, very intimate space. The people, if you're sitting on one particular side, your knees are literally brushing up against the bed.
Yeah, I was actually pretty much in the bed.
Well, I know there was one with the night I was there when he makes the bed, and he throws the blankets on, and I think it sort of went half over the sort of people sat on the first row. So I mean, it's a very brave thing to do, especially for a young actor, sort of to be that close to the audience. But I thought overall it was a great play. I thought it was very witty, warm, intelligent, and as you say, Christopher Hampton, far too talented for that, for someone that age, and so incredibly jealous, really. But yeah, I thought it was great.
Yeah, I mean, we should mention Abigail Crittenden and Sam Swainsbury.
Yes, of course. Yes.
Sam Swainsbury is the object of the crush, and Abigail Crittenden is his mother. And yes, things happen between the mother and Harry Melling's character. I thought it was, you know, it almost made me like Christopher Hampton, but I think it's very difficult for me to really like him. I was rather put off by an early production of Treats about 20 years ago with Tom Conti and Peter Capaldi and Julia Ormond. So sorry, just showing off, but I was just put off by that play and the sort of the attitudes of that play. It didn't get any better when I saw it again more recently, but you know, I've kind of mellowed on him slightly, and I'm certainly prepared to say that he's a bit of a genius, Christopher Hampton. So I have to put up with him. It's a nice piece. I mean, very, very 60s. It's very had a slight air of. I suppose the Ypres file about it, in that kind of slight dinginess, but also the style, you know, very the way that people were very stylish in what they wore, but although they're on fairly slender means, and certainly the men were, you know, could slightly do that. But yeah, it's good. I mean, quite good. A lot of fun. It's only open for the next week, which is why I wanted to get a talk about it at some point.
I think one of the crucial things, you mentioned Abigail Crittenden, and I think one of the crucial things in this play is the interplay between her character, Sir Jimmy's mother, and what's the name? I can't remember the name of Ian, Harry Melling's character, is the interplay between those two, because I think a lot of it depends on the actors and the casting, because you have to believe that, that sort of like, you know, middle-aged woman would fall for an 18-year-old, yeah, and vice versa, and you know, regardless of the sort of the motives, there has to be something that has to be believable, and I think in this instance it was.
Yeah, I do think though that I don't know what she's supposed to be written as. But if she was, you know, if you can do the sort of the maths, if he's sort of 18, 19, she might only be in her early 40s, if that. So yeah, although technically that's middle-aged. Once you reach your 40s, you sort of kind of wonder if it is actually middle-aged.
But, yes.
but so you could sort of see that, and she's not vampish in that. You know, you might normally expect it to be. She's actually rather repressed in her,
yes,
playing, which is what I think it's supposed to be like.
But she's not a sort of a what I call like a cardigan mum. She's, you know, she's not mumsy.
No.
And I think that's, you know, she's got an air of glamour about her, as well as a sort of an element of vulnerability, which I think sort of makes the character work.
You can follow the As Yet Unnamed London Theatre Podcast at AYULTP on Twitter. Find the As Yet Unnamed London Theatre Podcast page on Facebook, and at AYU-LondonTheatre.org on the web. Goodbye.